हेलो। वेरी वॉर्म वॉर्म वेलकम एंड गुड आफ्टरनून। दिस इज ऑन बिहाफ ऑफ जामिया टीचर सॉलिडारिटी एसोसिएशन, जामिया स्टूडेंट सॉलिडारिटी फोरम एंड फ्रेंड्स एंड कलीग्स ऑफ लेट प्रोफेसर इकबाल अंसारी। आई वेलकम यू टू दिस थर्ड प्रोफेसर इकबाल अंसारी मेमोरियल लेक्चर। प्रोफेसर अंसारी, इफ यू ऑल वुड बी फेमिलियर, बिगैन हिज करियर एज अ प्रोफेसर एज अ टीचर इन द डिपार्टमेंट ऑफ इंग्लिश इन अलीगढ़ मुस्लिम यूनिवर्सिटी। बट बियॉन्ड हिज इमीडिएट प्रोफेशनल कमिटमेंट्स, ही वॉज अ टायरलेस एक्टिविस्ट फॉर ह्यूमन राइट्स, माइनॉरिटी राइट्स सेक्टर। इट इज़ टू ऑनर हिम and his immense work and contribution in this field that this Iqbal Ansari Memorial Lecture was instituted on his demise. The topic, as it is all very clear, it's communal violence and the question of justice, notes from the field and the courtroom. And we have amongst us probably the most appropriate person to discuss this topic with and advocate Vrinda Grover, who is a familiar face on the TV in the courtroom as well as in Jamia Millia Islamia. And many of you who would be following cases of communal violence and efforts to ensure justice to the victims of violence would be aware that Vrinda has been associated with various such instances of as a lawyer on behalf of the victims. She's been associated with the Malyana case, wherein the PAC, the Provincial Armed Constabulary of the UP Police, is the culprit. She's associated with the 1984 Sikh riots and the report to the Nation, etc., which was a work of many of the human rights activists. She's been extremely supportive also on issues such as, she's the lawyer of Ishq Jahan's family and so many other such cases. So we have Vrinda Grover, who will be delivering the lecture, and the chair is, if you all will be familiar with her again, is Dr. Professor Farida Abdullah Khan, who was formerly a Dean of Educational Studies in Jamia Millia, and also one of the founding members of Jamia Teacher Solidarity Association, and currently she is a member of the National Minority Commission. I welcome both Vrinda Grover and Farida Khan, and now I request Professor Khan to chair the proceedings.
Welcome you all again. Thank you, Ranveer. I don't have much to say, but I think Ranveer has introduced both the Professor Ansari and Vrinda. I just a little bit more. Professor Ansari and I worked together many years ago on Kashmir, where he was the vice chairman of the Coordination Committee on Kashmir, and we did a fact-finding report together in Kashmir with Justice Dalkunde. He, as you all know, I think he's been associated with Jamia as well, which he started as a teacher of English at Aligarh Muslim University. He published widely on human rights issues and on minority issues. He worked in different parts of India and traveled all over in connection with riots, conflict situation, wherever there was, the state against different kinds of injustices being done. And I think, was that the time you were there? You know, and today I think Vrinda really, as Tanvir says, is really an appropriate and an excellent person to be delivering a lecture. teacher here. She is a lawyer of repute and has done really, really wonderful work wherever it was needed and when it's needed. I've always felt that she has a really astute and a mind and a way of actually just coming to the point where picking things where they're absolutely the important points in any case. I've seen her working. We have a personal association as well. We worked together in Silampur in 92 after the riots, and when there were rioting, communal riots around in Delhi and around Silampur. And we worked together for a few months trying to collect the cases and file cases. And Vrinda's capacity to actually come to the point to bring it, there were many academic discussions and people tend to get, you know, over emotional around such things, you tend to get bogged down in detail, but she has a really good lawyer's mind along with a really, really good you know, sensitivity to what is going on, where it's happening and how to deal with it. And I've seen it with her, and she's, you know, it's obviously been honed over the years, but every case she deals with and every case she presents has that quality to it. And she has worked tirelessly, really tirelessly, wherever there is a need for work like this to be done. And obviously is doing excellent work. Vrinda is right now at the Timurthy Foundation. She's done academic work as well as very much her activist work, along with her legal work in other areas as well. So I welcome her very warmly to this forum, and I'm sure all of you will, you know, this will be an enlightening lecture and a lecture for our times. I think something that we need to be very aware of and thinking about at the moment. So,
one thing I know for sure, that next time I'm feeling low and depressed, I'm going to call Farida. Okay. Because it's very nice to hear good things being said about your life, and you look at your week and you wonder, what the hell was I doing the whole week? I'm going to not necessarily talk too much about details of what's not happening in each case. I will intersperse a little bit of that, because I think many of us know what is happening in specific individual cases. I will, where I want to take this discussion is a little bit to the communal violence bill, which has been a subject of discussion for some time and keeps coming in the news and disappearing quite mysteriously almost. And is also something on which I think we've not really had a good public debate, or at least an informed public debate. What we have seen is people pitching in different directions, and a lot of what television and media does nowadays is not only ill-informed, but also tends to polarize opinion in ways which is not necessarily productive. But before I begin my presentation, I would like to acknowledge that I knew Professor Iqbal Ansari. He had been associated with the Hashimpura and Malyana killings in terms of raising the issue and seeing that there was some justice done. He was very tirelessly working with the survivors of Hashimpura, a case that was eventually then transferred to Delhi, where it is being prosecuted today. We're talking of a massacre of over 40 Muslim men at the hands of the Provincial Armed Constabulary close to Muzaffarnagar, where bodies were thrown in the Hindon Canal and in another canal in 1987. The case is still going on in these Sazari courts. And I think that's what ministers and others mean when they say the law must take its course. And that's the way the law does take its course. Professor Iqbal Ansari and I were engaged with that. For anyone who knew Professor Iqbal Ansari, he was a man of strong views, and we both often battled with contrary ideas. But his passion and his commitment was inspiring for all of us. Today what I want to touch upon are what are the main issues, and it could be, you know, nowadays when we talk of years like 87 Malayana Hashimpura, 83 Nelly, 84 Delhi, 92-93 Mumbai, 2002 Gujarat, 2012 or 2011 Assam, and then 2013 Muzaffarnagar. The list is growing and the list will keep growing. I think one of the biggest challenges that Indian democracy faces today, and I'm not a political theorist so I can't comment on it, is that actually communal violence pays good electoral dividends. It's been established, there is empirical evidence to prove what I'm saying, and therefore polarization of communities, whether it is by honoring, I don't know what that honoring really means, the word honor does get used very peculiarly amongst us, people who have incited mass crimes recently in Muzaffarnagar, or it is in the past, but we do see that on each occasion actually creating communal tension or even outbreak of communal violence and the subsequent polarization and ghettoization that takes place does have rich electoral dividends. And therefore there is no reason why this is going to stop. And the responsibility for it, or the fact that it does yield well, is not only to my mind on political class or political leaders. It is all of us who are also somewhere complicit in this game. So if it's not going to go away and it's not going to get wished away, and the political class derives a direct benefit from it, what are we going to do, we who are actually at the political class is benefiting, and the people of this country stand to lose a lot, both philosophically in terms of the complex and plural idea of India, but also in simple terms of life, livelihood, homes, suffering, injuries. So how are we going to engage with it, and how do we understand it? I'm going to try and talk a little bit about that. Kitna time hai bolna? I think what we know of all those situations, I'm talking only about communal violence, which is targeted violence, although I think many similar but not identical analogies or arguments can also be made about caste-related violence. But I'm not talking about that today. What we see is that what is known, and I, for me, 1984 was a personal turning point. I've lived in Delhi all my life. I was in college when the 1984, I was living in West Delhi. I was in college when the 1984 pogrom against the Sikhs happened. And I saw with my eyes how the system refused to respond, and how people, there were mobs and others who actually committed the arson and the killing. And for somebody who's born of parents who both came after partition into India, and one had grown up hearing from parents and grandparents stories of partition, 84 actually, in a sense, made me understand what they meant when they were talking about that kind of violence, because I think otherwise it's actually almost difficult to imagine that when you are living in these spaces, things can overturn so quickly and so drastically. However, the truth of all that which we know, which we see, which anybody who lived in Delhi knew, has never been able to translate itself into what is called proof beyond reasonable doubt, a very important principle of law and jurisprudence, which we hold very sacred and would not wish to forsake at all, did not get translated. So today you have 84 survivors and victims going to Karkaduma and other courts after whatever, over 20, almost 20 years, 30 years, seeking justice. We hear about them. We hear about the 1987 Hashimpura survivors going. We hear about some of the 93. And joining this very long march to elusive justice now are the survivors of Muzaffarnagar. So we have people who've been clocking this for 30 years, and others are continuously joining the same path. if we were to look at what is causing this, and I believe that there are entrenched regimes of impunity in the law, in the procedure, and I'm not necessarily going into the politics of it, I'm going to confine myself to the legal system and its processes, which need to be challenged and countered. We need to remember that we have inherited a colonial legal system. A colonial legal system, except for the constitution, which was passed on from the British regime. I think one of the, when one looks back in hindsight, perhaps one of the biggest concerns politically that one can today articulate is that there was no moment when the laws of this country were tried to be brought in consonance with the constitution. The constitution marks a very, very clear departure. And one can only, constantly applaud and appreciate the far-sightedness and the wisdom of those who were in the Constituent Assembly to bring to a country as hierarchical and stratified and polarized as ours principles of equality, etc., on which on a daily basis we peg our lives and rights and move ahead in this country. But we didn't necessarily do that with the criminal justice system. So you have a penal code. Anybody should pick up the Indian Penal Code and see which is the shortest chapter in the Indian Penal Code. It's called Offences Against Public Servants. And there is very good reason why that is the shortest chapter. What are the crimes in the Penal Code? It's crimes that I as an individual can commit against other individuals, to their body, to their property, to, crimes of counterfeit currency, cheating, fraud, etc., etc., or harming or injuring the body. Then there are crimes that groups can commit as an unlawful assembly or as a mob. Then there are crimes that with either as individuals or as groups we can commit against the state. So whether it is treason or war against the, waging war against the state, those are, or sedition, those are crimes that we as people can commit against the state or the government established by law. There is nothing which tells you that the state can commit any crime. The state is never in the dock in our formulation of law. There can be public servants who commit individual crimes, which would be in the nature of that if in discharging my duty, I am forging a document. I am deliberately writing something which I know to be untrue. Those are individual crimes that somebody is committing for personal gain. But we do not see the state as committing crimes against people as an entity where there is no individual personal gain to be derived. And that, to my mind, is a major issue, and to my mind it strikes a discordant note from the Constitution, at the heart of which lies Chapter 3 of Fundamental Rights, which places the citizens and rights of the citizens against the power and tyranny of the state, and holds that as the most sacred. And no law, nothing can be in violation of those fundamental rights which are given against abuse of power, arbitrary exercise of power to the individual or groups of citizens. However, the criminal legal system seems to not be a mismatch when it comes to the kernel and the philosophical base on which the Indian Constitution rests. So therefore, when we hear of, the 87 cases are going on, the 84 cases are going on, I don't think we need to be too shocked or too surprised. We need to be angry and we need to find answers and we need to meet these challenges somehow. But we should not necessarily be surprised by the impunity that is rampant around us. And therefore, the verdicts that come out, the invariable acquittals that we see, and very, very few and rare convictions, whether it is of Gujarat or it is of 84, which we celebrate as victories, but those remain as exceptions. Whether it is a Bilkis Bano case, which many of our friends were involved in, a case of gang rape during a genocidal attack on Muslims in Gujarat, which many people cite as perhaps one of the first times we got justice and punishment for sexual violence and targeting of a woman's body during this kind of violence. I always feel that, you know, actually it's not a case of best practices. What it says to us is that if you actually put these kind of enabling systems in place, if these standards are met by the state machinery, then women will be able to get justice. But that by itself is not a case of best practice. It took many people had to set their lives aside to get justice in one particular case. To my mind, it actually is, it is something to hold up to the state that justice is possible against all odds, but only if these, whether it is witness victim protection or special public prosecutors, etc., if that machinery is put in place. That, to my mind, is what Bilkis Banu reflects, and not something that I necessarily hail as a best practice. I think it's something to show to the state. So what is it when we, what I would like to discuss here is that beyond this lament of injustice, how do we identify why the law and judiciary fails to deliver to victims of and survivors of communal carnage, and how do we then find answers and what is the way forward? The present legal system has failed to award penalty for communal crimes, for these events overturn some fundamental premises on which the criminal justice system is based. The rubric of the Indian Penal Code, the Indian Evidence Act, and the Code of Criminal Procedure is not designed to adjudicate and punish the perpetrators of communal pogroms. And that is because it sees the state as the protector. It sees the people as the aggressor. It sees the people as the ones who will therefore commit the wrongs. And somewhere our experiences actually today tell us that the equation appears to have changed very, very drastically. The violence unleashed against the Sikhs in 1984 Delhi, Muslims in 2002 Gujarat, Christians in 2008 Odisha, Kandhamal, and now Assam and Muzaffarnagar is usually labeled in law as riots. The term riot, defined in section 146 of the Indian Penal Code, or the commonly used phrase communal riot, implies a violent clash between members of different religious communities, causing loss of life, limb, and property to both. This phrase is inaccurate to describe the communal violence under discussion, which is premeditated and organized targeting of the minority community, sanctioned with explicit and or implicit sanction and support of the state, its representatives and functionaries. I'm not saying all of them. I personally do not agree that they are all genocides. I think there are different degrees, and it's good to classify them as pogroms or genocidal attacks, whatever be the actual nature and the gravity of the attack. A corollary would be that the list of accused persons to be prosecuted must include not only those whose hands killed, sexually assaulted, looted, burnt, but the minds that planned, incited, abetted, conspired, provided financial and other resources, as well as those who abandoned their constitutional duty to protect the people caught in the vortex of communal violence. So here we need to therefore have a completely new language and a new definition to describe what is the nature of the violence that we are talking about, and not the manner in which law traditionally and conventionally describes it. And this language is not, we don't have to discover this language actually. This language has been somewhere, it has evolved a little bit as a little bit of jurisprudence in our midst through Supreme Court and other, now even some very important trial court judgments, but a lot also through the international law. And we need to, if we want to keep calling ourselves the greatest democracy and the burgeoning economy, and you want to get that place in the global, you know, amongst the global powers, you also need to make sure that your laws and your systems reflect that modern systems of accountability that the international law today holds out. So what does the legal system broadly comprise of, from the police to the prosecution to the courts? I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the police. I think each individual sitting here will have one example to cite about the police, and it's something that has been studied, understood to a large degree. But I think we are in a crisis in this country where we do not have. And this is not a crisis that anybody is being able to answer. And the Supreme Court is actually confessing to that crisis. For most many of the Gujarat cases which have made any headway, which have gone anywhere, whether it is the Naroda Patia case or others, what did the Supreme Court do? It appointed a special investigating team. What is a special investigating team? Can anybody show me the existence of an SIT mechanism in any statute, in any law book? It doesn't exist. It is an admission by the court that the present systems are not working. And therefore, you are creating new mechanisms to fill the void because you know that the present machinery is complicit, the present machinery is collusive, and the present machinery will not deliver what it is meant to give. And this creating of SITs, whether for cases of fake encounters, extrajudicial killings, or of for communal pogroms and targeted violence, is to my mind an admission by the highest court of land that our the machinery that we have on the ground is not working. As one of our most leading human rights lawyer, Mr. K.G. Kanabaran, had once remarked that what, you know, this whole business of transferring cases out of Gujarat into somewhere else, the Hashimpura case out of UP into Delhi, it seems as though the rule of law is running like a refugee, trying to find some space where it can hold its own and be, and can, you know, actually be applied and enforced. So it is a recognition and an acknowledgement that yes, the force on the ground is not working, and therefore we will bring in extraordinary mechanisms which have no rooting in law. And then Supreme Courts or High Courts actually monitor the whole process themselves, because not only do they create the mechanism, they are still not sure that this mechanism will not be overawed by powerful forces. And therefore they monitor it themselves to get the appropriate results, and then we see a little bit of movement in cases, but it shops, you know, the minute the courts are also hesitant to carry on for too long, and then they feel that okay, we've done enough, now we need to back off. We have this very peculiar way in which we understand justice in this country. There's a lot of adjustment which is going on within the judicial system. We give a little, we move back, etc. So there is a crisis in so far as an independent investigating agency in this country is concerned. The CBI is not an independent investigating agency. And I'm not interested in whether we want to call it a caged parrot and the kind of you know, things that are being exchanged between the BJP and the Congress, neither of which really come with clean hands on any count. I appeared for one of the widows of 1984, about 3 years ago, in a Karkaduma court, where Teitler, a very prominent Congress leader in Delhi, who had been accused of having incited the mob for having near a Gurudwara, and then the mob set fire to the Gurudwara. 3 men died in the Gurudwara, apart from a lot of loss of property, etc. And one of the men was the husband of this woman. The CBI filed a charge sheet by which they said, in a charge sheet you have a column where you can put the names of a person who was under the scanner of your investigation, but you find that there is no evidence. So you put his name in a column which says that there is no evidence against this accused, so there is no, this charge sheet is not against this accused. Jagdish Teitler's name, not surprisingly, was in that column. In law, the affected party can file what is called a protest petition in court. So we filed a protest petition challenging that charge sheet, that there was not enough evidence before the CBI to actually file the charge sheet against Jagdish Teitler. The charge sheet was never given to us. It was a voluminous document. We were told you have to come and sit here and inspect. We don't have a choice. We sat and inspected it. It was an amazing charge sheet. I had never read such a charge sheet in a very, very long time. I wish many more charge sheets, particularly of UAPA, POTA, etc., would look like this. One would have a little bit more faith in what is going on in this country. So if one witness says in this charge sheet to the CBI that I saw Jagdish Teitler standing there at this time and inciting the mob, ki aapki maa ko mara hai aur aap chup nahi reh sakte aur in logon ko chhodna mat, they will find 3 witnesses who will say, no, I was also present there. But I did not see Jagdish Taitler say any such thing. Okay. Then another witness will say, I escaped from the Gurdwara and I went and hid here. Then they will find three witnesses who will say, no, 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 he did not escape from the Gurdwara, he was in X place. So for every witness who gave evidence which would be evidence again for the presence of Jagdish Taitler and to his act of criminality of inciting and abetting the mob, they would find three other people who would deny that this had happened in this manner. This was all in the charge sheet. I have two responses to this. One, in a riot situation, actually, three people standing at the same spot can see totally different things. It would be natural for three people who are standing in the same place, all of whom are trying to escape, being killed, lynched, burned to death, to actually not see the same thing and not hear the same thing. Secondly, I want to see any other charge sheet that the CBI has ever filed, barring in cases of this nature, where they have said that, okay, this is evidence that is going in our favor. Remember, CBI is the prosecuting agency, investigating and prosecuting agency. That this is going in our favor as a prosecuting agency. We are now getting evidence against the accused, and they make efforts to cross-check and verify that and to find that is everybody else also supporting this person. I have never seen any investigating agency in this country exercise that kind of diligence to verify that did everybody else do this, but we found it in the Jagdish Taitler charge sheet. And there are no surprises for guessing, and therefore when people are angry and they say all political parties indulge in this, there is merit to that argument. The way the system is manipulated and used and abused. So we held lengthy arguments. The magistrate was extremely impressed with our arguments. He also said, "Arey, maine to kitna law sikha aap logon se." We of course got an order against us. Then we had to go to the sessions court, which admitted it. And so the battle continues. It's still going on in the sessions court whether there will be evidence against him or not. We also brought to the notice of the court that there are three witnesses, one of whom is now living in the US, who are repeatedly saying that we can give evidence, and one of them was the Granthi of that Gurudwara. The CBI first couldn't find him, then we gave his address, and then they had other reasons to say, no, 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 he's not telling the truth, etc. So it's also the burden of collecting that evidence and giving that evidence is upon you. What we cannot do, and we should not do, is that we cannot become an investigating agency. That power remains with them, and that power stands highly, highly compromised and politically controlled. I'm deliberately taking an example from 84 because I think there is a lot of conversation that happens around 2002. And yes, I politically believe that 2002 and 84 are distinct in political terms. But in terms of anybody seeking justice, whether it is this widow or anybody else, I think they have equal rights to fight for that justice, and any undermining of that process should be commented upon. And so we have that the absence of an independent and effective investigating agency is felt most acutely when victims and survivors have to beseech the very police force that through myriad acts of omission and commission was complicit in the communal crimes. Experiences, now I want to come to another point which came up recently in political debate and discussion, but in a very skewed way, and immediately the way we now have what we call public conversation or public debate, which I really cannot understand why we have begun as a nation to talk to each other or talk or debate ideas in this form. The Home Minister, Mr. Shinde, had sent some letter to the police saying that make sure that there is not that minorities, or perhaps he said Muslims should not be specifically targeted while investigating anti-terror crimes. It created a huge furore. He had to apologize, whatever. And the BJP went on an overdrive to say, oh, so other people can be discriminated and terrorized. I was actually surprised why the Home Ministry went on a back foot on that at all. I personally do not think that letter may have been worded wrongly. That letter may have, should perhaps have been have communicating in a different way, particularly if it is coming from the Home Minister. But what the letter was alluding to is a matter of fact today. And I think work done by teachers of this university under JTSA actually establishes that through empirical evidence. And we are living in a denial mode. I firmly believe, and I can prove this to anybody who wishes to see it, and through not through terror cases, but through communal violence cases, that there is an institutional bias in the police against religious minorities. It is not confined to religious minorities. That institutional bias runs against Dalits, it runs against Adivasis, it runs against women, it runs against Kashmiris, it runs against many others. But this is no longer an aberration. I remember a year and a half ago, the National Commission for Minorities, under Mr. Wajahat Habibullah, the chairperson, had organized a meeting on calling police officers from a very senior police officers from across the country and talking to them about how minorities are treated. Speaker after speaker from different states came up and said that yes, there was a targeting of minorities that was going on. But when a couple of us over there presented the idea that this is not an individual thing happening in your state of Madhya Pradesh or your state of Kerala or anywhere else, there is a pattern that can be seen, and therefore we have to research it. My plea to the NCM there, and I'm deliberately saying it so that Farida can push these ideas, my plea to the NCM there was, you don't have to accept because some of us are saying that there is an institutional bias. Please research it. It's a subject of study and research. Let us see whether it holds true or not. There was huge denial from the same people who had finished presenting these massive stories, each story worse than the other that one could hear. But complete denial that this is happening systemically, or that therefore it needs corrective measures and remedies, which cannot be individual. You know, you can't pick an individual officer, you can't grant individual compensation and wish it away. Institutional bias is a term that actually emerged, and maybe the term is earlier, but it was discussed and understood and defined through a very important commission called the Sir Macpherson Commission, which was constituted in England, I can't remember when, but I think it was either late 80s or 90s, where after the killing of a young black boy at a bus stop by some random white boys, his parents, there was the investigation that was done, was very shoddy and nothing really came out of the investigation. The boy's parents for years kept agitating that this requires a deeper interrogation into the system. This is not about killing only our son. When the government then set up what was called the Sir Macpherson Commission, and it examined the patterns of violence that had taken place as far as the police in England, or maybe it was confined to London, I cannot recall. And through that, it said that yes, there exists institutional racism in the police against the black men or the black community here, and therefore a slew of recommendations, which would include things like changing composition, having different kinds of interface with the community, and many, many measures, and not just what are you going to do in that case and how are you going to penalize individual officers. In this country, police officers have done studies which actually show that there is institutional bias. Long time ago, a person who was deeply in the police force, Mr. V.N. Rai, was deeply impacted by the Malayana Hashimpura killings, did his own PhD as a serving police officer, and wrote that there is a bias against the Muslims in the police force, and this he did in the early 90s. We still are not ready to come to terms whether this exists, and if it does, what are we going to do, and how does the system correct this problem? And therefore, we continue to see, whether it is in the UAPA cases or other cases, that the courts will comment on the, and a court cannot take this call. This is a call that has to be taken by somebody else, because the court can only see the forensic truth and not the larger picture, and it shouldn't see the larger picture. But we don't have mechanisms which are even engaging with this, and I think that's a serious problem that we have today. I actually would like to stretch the point of bias, and I think the point of bias is today extending beyond the police. It's actually very easy to say that the police is biased, and we may also at some point of time get people who will agree that yes, there is an issue. हमें क्या हिंदी में बात करनी पड़ेगी? So that is in so far as the police is concerned, where I think we need to move ahead. And just to touch one small law point here, where, and this is a change that has been brought about in law as far as violence against women is concerned, and I think it needs to be brought about dramatically in any constitutional democracy across the board, again a legacy of our colonial laws. We have what is called section 197 of the Criminal Procedure Code. What does it say? You cannot prosecute any public servant. The public servant can be a bureaucrat, a minister, a parliamentarian, a judge, a police officer, an army officer, anybody who is within the government cannot be prosecuted until and unless you take permission from the appointing authority, which is obviously the executive itself, whether the person can be prosecuted, what is called prior sanction for prosecution. It's a very strange thing to exist where we have equality before the law and equal treatment of all before the law. It's a provision that was brought in when the British were ruling India. It was called now it's called sanction for public servants. That time it was called sanction for servants of the crown. The only change we made after independence was to replace servants of the crown with public servants, and nothing else was changed. What does this ask us to do? It says that if you want to prosecute a police officer for an extrajudicial killing or a cold-blooded murder, you need to go and ask his boss, his appointing authority, the Home Minister, that can I prosecute him? Just imagine in Gujarat, you're going to ask the Home Minister that can I prosecute the police officer who has committed the extrajudicial killing. There are no prizes for guessing what the answer is going to be. What does one make of this, and why does it need to be challenged? Why was it brought in? It was brought in because at that time it was felt that the masses, which is the people of this country who were being ruled by a colonial power, would want to implicate the foreign rulers in many vexatious, frivolous and other forms of litigation. Why should it be assumed that the people of this country, in an independent India, would want to file false, vexatious litigation against its own public servants who are discharging their public duty? I actually don't think that our legal system currently is working in a way that people are rushing to court to file anything unless they really have to do it. However, we continue to retain, and it's a privilege, that no parliamentarian and no bureaucrat is willing to let go of. With a lot of difficulty, the first time we have made an inroad into this legal immunity, which actually leads to a lot of impunity, very, very starkly in places like Kashmir and Manipur, is a little less apparent to us in these parts of the country, where if a person is going to be charged with any form of sexual violence, be it sexual harassment, molestation, voyeurism, stalking, rape, whatever, you cannot say that you will have to take prior sanction. If you are charged with it, you will be prosecuted. What is the difficulty? If you and I are charged with something, we are prosecuted. What do? We go and submit ourselves before the courts of law. The court weighs the evidence and the court decides whether I'm innocent or guilty. How come the people who are running the system have such little faith in the judiciary? Why don't they subject themselves to the same judiciary and allow the judiciary to weigh the evidence and see if they are guilty or innocent? That remains a huge challenge, and I think it's a challenge to constitutional democracy which should not be allowed to subsist any longer. I want to now move to very quickly to two, three things. The first being prosecution. Prosecution in this country, the prosecutorial system in this country, unlike say England or elsewhere, is under the state. It is under the Home Department of the state. So you have a system where the prosecutor is not actually enjoying either institutional autonomy or functional discretion. Post Gujarat, we heard many instances which therefore the Supreme Court had to step in and appoint special public prosecutors, again moving, departing from the ordinary process of law, although special public prosecutors are provided in law, but clearly recognizing that if you allow the law to take its own course, it will go only towards injustice. In the Hashimpura case, after it had been transferred to Delhi, it was going nowhere. We asked for the appointment of a special public prosecutor. The first one that we got was a young lawyer who was related to somebody in the UP law ministry. We were able to find out that he lacked the necessary number of years to be appointed a special public prosecutor, so we could get rid of him. Then they appointed a second one who was then related to somebody else in the UP bureaucracy, and who would just refuse to open the file and read it, and there is no way you can make a lawyer open a file and read it. So what do you do to get rid of him? We wrote letters to the UP government saying, please appoint a special public prosecutor, gave them a list of names saying, can you appoint any one of them? We never got a reply from anyone. About 40 families of Hashimpura who had lost these, and they are very poor people. Somebody is a fruit vendor, somebody works on a par loom, somebody runs a little shop there. We decided we have to create pressure on the UP government because they're not going to listen to us. So we filed 600 odd right to information applications asking the same thing. Every family filed against each of the 19 accused persons, all members of the PAC, saying we want their annual confidential reports, we want to know whether they were suspended, we want to know what actions were taken. That in itself was a dramatic story that got revealed for those people who, like Mr. Prakash Singh, who spearheads this so-called police reform campaign and say that internal mechanisms will suit and will the police will rectify itself. When we filed those RTI applications and we got the annual confidential reports, we didn't file them sitting in Hashimpura. All of us went to Lucknow and we, in solidarity with all the human rights and civil liberties groups and activists, stood in solidarity with those people of Hashimpura, and we went in a large procession and went and filed the 600 RTI applications, which shook the administration of Lucknow, both to give us answers to our RTI as well as to appoint the special public prosecutor. It's not a process known in law that you go and do this and then you get a special public prosecutor, but that's the way it works in this country. We got the answers out of the RTI, and in the RTI they had said, for each of the accused persons, if you were to read only their annual confidential reports, there is not a whisper that any of them is even facing a prosecution under murder. Forget mass murder. To my mind, Hashimpura is the worst case of communal custodial killing. You read the ACRs and somewhere it will say, bahut anushasit sipahi hai, hamari kabaddi team ka member hai. And it goes on like this. You can read year after year, and if that was the only document available to you, you would never get to know that the same Sipahi is facing a murder prosecution in Delhi even as his ACR is being written. It is not even mentioned in the ACR. And those are your internal mechanisms that these police reform campaign, and I make a distinction between what Mr. Prakash Singh leads and what human rights groups leads. I don't think he has anything to do with human rights. When they say that we will internally hold ourselves accountable, they have what they want to do is that they want insulation and independence from the executive so that they are a law unto themselves. I'm not very sure, at least we can change our parliamentarians through elections and hold them accountable. What will you do with a police force that will be answerable to no one and has an institutional bias embedded inside it? So that is where we stand with prosecution. The problem at one part, and I'm only going to mention this, these two, three things with the law. Invariably we've seen, and particularly with Gujarat, where strenuous efforts, and I think Indian jurisprudence has grown hugely by through the efforts of activists who work and are continuing to work and pursue cases relating to Gujarat, where efforts have been made to hold accountable and criminally culpable people who gave the orders and who were responsible from the top. But on each occasion we are seeing, not only politically but I believe legally, we falter. And I think there are reasons for it. And we need to change the law on that count. We need to integrate into Indian law what is a well-known doctrine of international criminal law, the doctrine of command responsibility and superior responsibility. Very often you will hear in the newspaper that the head of Liberian state has been held responsible by the International Criminal Court and he has been arrested. Surely the head of Liberia did not personally go and kill people, torch their houses, burn them, rape women. He did not. He had a set of people who were doing this for him. How does he get held accountable? Because here we are told, where is the evidence? The evidence exists because what does the international criminal law doctrine says? It says if the commission of these crimes is, if the people committing the crime are within your effective control and authority, or if you have knowledge that they are committing or about to commit the crime, and you do not take necessary steps to prevent the commission of that crime, or later you do not take necessary steps to prosecute them, then you as the head of those people who are subordinate to you are criminally liable and culpable. So you don't have to do it, but your position as the superior, your position as the commander, and here it is because you are very clearly holding state power and authority. In that position, if you are not taking action, then under international criminal law, you are criminally liable and culpable. We do not have this doctrine in our criminal law. Yes, the parliamentarians will resist having this doctrine. Let us take the example of Kandhamal. In 2008, and I'll just after that read one, the Lakhan and Saraswati judgment is out where people have been convicted. In 2008, when Lakhanand Saraswati was killed, there was a there are also very striking similarities and patterns that are followed. There was a procession that was taken out with his body. If you put the map of Kandhamal as the districts, Kandhamal is a district, as the areas through which it went in Odisha, you can actually put the map of the rioting that took place and the burning, or followed exactly the same route as the funeral procession did. We've seen this in other places too. Could the district magistrate and the SP of Kandhamal not have anticipated that taking out this procession in this manner, in a volatile atmosphere where slogans were being shouted, where Christian community, and of course we hold an entire community responsible for the killing of a man which can only be executed by a few people, were being raised, and this funeral procession is allowed and the riot spreads. If an SP and DM allow this to happen, is there any penalty for this act of omission that they commit? A public servant can commit both an act of omission or commission. Under Indian law, there is no penalty for any such thing. But clearly, here are people who need to be held accountable for having not used their state power in an appropriate way. And therefore, there is a need to bring in certain new principles into our criminal law system. So when we keep using the yardstick of normal times and try and work strenuously to apply it to what can only be described as extraordinary times, the law falters, not just because there is bias and there is politics at play, but also because somewhere the structure of law and the language and vocabulary of law is wanting. And that's where perhaps we need to move when we talk of a new communal violence bill or a new communal violence law. Before I go there, and I'll just take 10 more minutes at the most, I just want to read out to which, to my mind, when I say the bias no longer exists only in the police. This is a judgment given by the Fast Track Court in Phulbani, where in the case where Lakhanand Saraswati was killed. And I think it's usually very hard to figure out or to say whether the judiciary is revealing any bias. And sometimes there are judgments which make it a slightly easier task. I'll read from the judgment. Hindu monk Vedanta Keshari Swami Lakhanand Saraswati, hereinafter referred to as Swamiji, was brutally murdered in his hermitage in the district of Kandhamal by some unknown assailants on the sacred day of Janmashtami, that is 23rd August 2008. He was a highly revered spiritual leader whose life was dedicated to tribal welfare. It is on record that Swamiji combated fraudulent conversion by Christian missionaries and a supporter of anti-cow slaughter movement. He was working for socio-economic well-being of marginalized and indigent in Kandhamal. And it is alleged that the missionaries, those use charity as a facade for converting people away from their native faith with alliance of Maoists, are the perpetrators and conspirators of the assassination of Swamiji. Then the assassination caused widespread rioting, etc. And then he goes on to say, in the present case, it is clear from the evidence of PW14 that Swamiji was a protester of cow slaughter and a pioneer among Hindu fundamentalists, and was looking after the education, health and general development of the weaker section of society. A month prior to the present incident, at his instance, a criminal case was initiated for slaughtering of cows for which there was a threat to his life. During cross-examination, this witness has given further clarity and stated that during year so and so, there was an attack on the life of Swamiji by Christians. I've never understood how he can say by Christians. No, I mean, who has attacked him? The work of Swamiji for upliftment of tribal community of Phulbani, beside preventing conversion, has definitely created bad blood among the Christian community. And then he goes on describing how his Swamiji was working against cow slaughter. And so he uses this to say that therefore he believes the court has got every reason to believe that because of the welfare activities of Swamiji and his organizations, the missionaries operating in the locality bore a grudge and wanted to eliminate him and have got a strong motive for that purpose. And he goes on speaking like this, and somewhere in the middle he says, the case at hand is a classic example in which one of the luminary of Hindu community who dedicated the whole life for the upliftment of the tribal community in this underdeveloped district of Odisha lost his life. So that is the language in which he's writing a judgment of a criminal trial. In a criminal trial, you have to appreciate evidence. Does the evidence show that the people who have been presented by the prosecution, is there evidence to show that there was a conspiracy? Is there evidence to show that these are the people who have killed? I'm not going into the details of this case. The evidence is, to say the least, of an extremely dubious character. In one place, there is one student of Lakhanan Saraswati's ashram, one girl student, who gives a statement very late. We know how these statements are presented and how the police files these statements. Now you have to explain why the statement is being made after so long. The prosecution will have to explain it. They came up with what I can only comment is a truly original stroke of imagination. They say this girl is a student of Sanskrit, and students of Sanskrit have a very good memory. This is the argument that the public prosecutor presents. Theek hai bhai, wo prosecutor bechare ko samjhana hai to usne bana di argument. We are also hard pressed at times. Hum bhi aise kuch bol dete hain court mein. The judge says, yes, he is right. Students of Sanskrit have a very strong memory. So even though she made the statement after so many days, she remembered all the details and could recognize the persons who, of course, came in masks, recognize the persons who had committed this murder. So we have a case here where people have been convicted. It's a unique alliance of Christians and Maoists in killing Swamiji. So that is where we are, and that is where the state of affairs in this country is, and why we need to have a slightly different framework to engage with this. The Communal Violence Bill was promised by the UPA government in 2004 when it came to power the first time. It said we'll bring about a comprehensive legislation to tackle communal violence. Their second term is about to get over. In 2005, they presented a bill. The bill actually drew upon AFSPA and disturbed areas and created what is called communally disturbed areas. The experience of the Disturbed Areas Act, haunting as it is, clearly shows that it actually is a huge threat to civil liberties. While our analysis, when I say our, I mean people who've engaged with it, the civil liberties groups, the individuals, the activists, repeatedly shows that no outbreak of communal violence, whether it is Muzaffarnagar or Gujarat or Delhi, cannot happen, or Kandhamal, until and unless there is explicit or implicit state sanction and support for that kind of violence. Therefore, the argument would be that the law needs to hold people in position of state power and authority accountable. And that is the impunity that the law allows for even today. And the law lacks creating that accountability. Instead, what the bill that is still pending in Rajya Sabha does is it creates communally disturbed areas where it gives even more power to the SP and the DM. As though there was the riot is being caused because the state did not have sufficient power to stop the riot. Whereas all fact-finding documentation will tell you the riot happened because the state power was either not used or abused and misused. Therefore, if you are going to add to the arsenal of state power, it is not going to either prevent or deter the violence. It is only going to further strengthen the targeting of the violence that is taking place against the religious minority. Therefore, what one is focusing on and what has been is that how do you create accountability? The whole debate in the last 1 year has largely happened, and I think we need to retrieve that space from parties like the BJP, where they have, and somewhere I think the government is at fault. My personal opinion is that the government actually has no interest in passing this bill. So the government is happy to put out a bill which they know will never go through the parliament. You and I cannot pass a bill. You need to create political consensus. In parliament, bills can only be passed after some negotiation. The bill will not be the best bill that we would like, but it will be a bill that will see and become law. The government, to my mind, other people engaged in this do not necessarily hold the same opinion, deliberately wants to put forward a bill that the BJP will object to and not allow in any way to pass. And therefore, you can always, at the time of campaigning for next general election, say, "Humne to koshish kari, dekho humne to bill dala. BJP wale kitne bure hain, unhone bill pass nahi hone diya." Isliye, you know, it's a situation where I think the government can easily say heads I win, tails you lose, and you can go back to this so-called community who you think you are going to, you know, can fool over and over again, and say to them, "We tried our best, but you know, your real enemy is out there." And I think this bluff and malafide of the government needs to be called also. Instead of focusing on the group and saying the law should provide protection to the group, and the group in the NAC draft is defined as a minority community, let the law provide protection to anybody and everybody who is impacted by communal violence to whatever degree. It is true that in Muzaffarnagar, the main brunt of the violence, the dislocation, the displacement, the sexual violence has been borne by Muslim community. There were at least a few Jats who were killed. Let the protection of law be offered to those families also. Why not? I actually don't have an issue with it. You need to remove that group aspect if this bill is ever to come before, is ever to pass through Indian Parliament. Because the BJP raises the ante and says, "Oh, this is a bill only for the minorities, it is not good for us." How do we create, when we are asking for systems of accountability of public servants, that should be the thrust of the bill. The thrust of the law should be all public servants should be accountable for crimes of commission and omission. And it would be interesting to see how the BJP will then argue that they don't think public servants in this country should be accountable. So it's important also when we are engaged in political work to have a little sense of strategy and to see where to take things forward. So I strongly believe that it is the accountability aspect that needs to be stressed and not get mired in the group debate, which actually serves the end of both parties or all parties. Elements of command and superior responsibilities, principle of constructive responsibility, these are just legal concepts which I'm not going to go into, but basically all systems of creating accountability, codifying new offences which are committed by public servants, changing the procedure relating to investigation evidence gathering. There have been cases of gang rape in Muzaffarnagar. I have met those women. There will not be any medical evidence. They were taken to the hospital for medical evidence after 1 month. What is the point of that? So how are you going to prove that there was sexual assault without medical evidence also? A robust witness victim protection. The women of Fugana village who have faced gang rape, they have named the accused in the FIRs. Not one of them has been arrested. Everybody is very excitedly saying that if we know there is an accused, we must get an FIR and we must get him arrested. I agree with it completely. But there are FIRs lying with accused named. Can somebody put some effort to get them also arrested? those women have been told that if you come to make a statement in court, we will shoot you dead in the courtroom. And yet we get reports from statutory bodies, people have to go back to the villages. If the conditions are not there for them to go back, they will not be able to go back. If they want to pursue these cases, they will not be able to go back. We have large sections of people from Gujarat, from 84, and now from Muzaffarnagar, from Kandhamal, who are now living in Bhubaneswar, who are internally displaced persons. We are not able to get a recognition on law of the rights that should flow to internally displaced persons and responsibilities of the state. And the last point that I wish to make, that the second pillar on which the communal violence law needs to stand, why is it that when people are killed in Delhi, they get 4 lakh rupees after many years and litigation? People in Hashimpura were able to get 4,20,000 for the dead. The injured got nothing, although some of them have permanent disability. In Gujarat, a lesser amount was given. How can it be totally dependent on the whims of the very executive that allows the communal carnage to take place, to determine what will be my reparative justice? Or you have to go to court. From the setting up of relief camps, rescuing, relief camp, compensation, rebuilding homes, restitution, reparation, apology, and guarantee of non-recurrence of this kind of communal violence, which is the legal term for this entire set, is reparation. In this country, unfortunately, we continuously call it compensation. Compensation is a small segment of that. Is left totally, even that small segment is left totally and completely to the whims of the executive. There is nowhere is it written what are the principles on which, how much is to be given, in how much time will it be given. Even if you have a motor accident in this country, the law has a set of principles by which it calculates what you will be given. If you are a victim of communal violence in this country, it depends on the whims of that state government. Of course, the activists and the survivors can then fight legal battles for 10, 20 years, which is exclusively their burden. And if they get a better deal out of court, good for them. These are some of the crucial things that need to be brought into that legislation. The legislation continues, the bill continues to be spoken about in a very, very vitiated way. There are ways of extracting it from that conversation and placing the real issues so that all parties can be made to answer some serious questions. We are entering the last session of Parliament. It is an unkept promise of the UPA government. The UPA government will use, to my mind, I could be wrong, maybe they have better faith, maybe actually they're going to produce a beautiful bill and pass it through Parliament. I'd be very happy to be proven wrong, but I think they're going to use it as an issue in elections without actually delivering on the promise that was made. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. I've been proven right once again about my capacities for you to come to the crucial points and bring them out fully. I think she's done a marvelous job of bringing to our attention really where the issues lie, what are the aspects of communal violence, what the police does, what the state does, and who's responsible, and those complicit in it. So I think, I don't want to speak too much, I think Brenda is also in a hurry, but there's question and answers,
yeah?
We can take two or three questions, so I'm sure some people there would want to ask.
First of all, thanks for this enlightening talk. Somewhere in your talk you said that the judiciary, particularly I'm focusing here on the higher judiciary, should not take a long-term view and should focus on what's being presented. I mean, and you said rather, if I'm not wrong, that the bigger picture is something which the judiciary should not make which focus to.
Okay.
Exactly. So here we see that apart from these cases of systemic communal violence, or rather institutional biasness, judiciary takes a long, looks at the big picture in most of the cases, whether it be a 2G scam, whether it be a Vodafone case, or for example, the classic case of the Babri Masjid issue from the But then, do you think that these parties, which seem to be political parties, which seem to be entrenched in a political system for the next 100 years, may be hand in glove with respect to this situation, without judicial innovation of that kind, taking in the larger picture, is anything with respect to jurisprudence particularly possible in any way?
Actually, what I was obviously not clear on that aspect. I said it in passing. What I was saying is that when I was talking about the lower judiciary, not the higher judiciary, when a criminal court, a trial criminal court, is looking at certain facts and is looking at the case before itself, it's important for that court to focus on those facts, unlike what the Lakhanan Saraswati judge decides to look at. And you know, clearly his own inclination about whether a judge likes to slaughter cows or not, doesn't like to slaughter cows, should not be what should be determining his decision making in a criminal trial. So that is what I was saying. I think it was a little misunderstood. I totally agree with you that when it comes to the higher judiciary, they need to take a larger perspective. They need to factor in the other processes that are happening, without which our jurisprudence would not evolve. Unfortunately, my sense of what is happening with the judiciary is that they begin that, but they are very hesitant to move in that direction, and they feel that would people be seeing this as a judicial overreach? Would people be seeing that we are going beyond what our immediate reliefs were asked for? And that is why our jurisprudence is developing in an extremely halting and ad hoc fashion. For instance, I think the Naroda Patia judgment is an excellent example of how, even in a trial court, on the basis of evidence, you can actually appreciate what is happening in that situation. It's perhaps one of the rare occasions when we've seen a sting operation being taken as valid evidence. Unlike the work that I've done in 1984, actually showed that because they were going to follow the letter of the law in such black and white terms, so if the person says, "I got the FIR 3 months late," it's like, oh my God, there are so many judgments of the Supreme Court which say if the FIR is not late, that means you made up the entire case. Without counting that obviously if you're living in a relief camp, you don't know whether you're going to have a home, you're not rushing to the police station when you've lost faith in that police. Those factors we now see that courts are beginning to take cognizance of, whereas they didn't do, say, 10, 15 years ago. So certainly, unless and until those aspects come in, we will not see an evolution of jurisprudence, I agree with you. But I am not sure how determined the judiciary is to go down that route.
My question is that, is there any proper representation from the minority commission, police, judiciary, and that may be one problem. I think for the protecting a community, the own representatives are listed, especially in the time of violence. And also, when you presented that Kulbani court case, I done my MA thesis in police violence. So, that is wondering that how the life of a man or the life of a cow is more important for the judiciary. How much violence?
The judiciary has read all the holy scriptures, which I haven't. What can I do? I agree with you that I think partially the problem can be dealt with by increasing the representation, whether it is in the police or the judiciary, but I don't find that necessarily as the attractive way forward in a country like ours. I think that people who are going to assume office of this nature, there needs to be a very clear method in which they have to work. And if they depart from it, I don't care what their origin is, what religious affiliation they hold or don't hold. How do we make it irrelevant to the extent that it doesn't bias? People should have their own faith. I have no issue with it. People should have their faith. Some people derive a lot of strength from their faith. And for instance, let's say somebody like Justice Sri Krishna. Justice Sri Krishna has written one of the best Commission of Inquiry reports ever produced in the 1992-93 communal violence, naming police officers. Justice Sri Krishna is a practicing Hindu. I don't have an issue with what somebody's religious orientation or faith or practice is. How do you ensure that that does not necessarily come in the way when you are doing your work as a statutory authority. Though I do agree with you that some of the experiences that you have, whether it is as a Dalit or as a Muslim or as a woman, I think I do agree to some plurality and diversity in statutory bodies particularly, so that those experiences can be brought in, because clearly those are lacking. But I think that would be one small step, and not, it won't give us all the answers.
I have a question. Why the minority is a caricature in the majority? If we take example like of Germany and United States, earlier they had been applied in their communities, but they still improved a lot, and that's why.
It's a comment, it's not a question.
No, it's a question, ma'am.
I don't think I'll answer. We'll let Farida answer.
Okay, I'd just like to thank Nirva very much, and I hope it's, you know, what all of us thinking. There's been a lot of violence, as she says, and it's likely to increase and not to decrease. So we are seeing what's happening. I think it's quite disturbing in the point of also, you know, should there be more representation and therefore things might get better. And as Vrinda says, I think that sensitivity is important. It's also important to understand why certain communities aren't represented in certain, for example, the police force with the Sachar Committee report. We know that there's really a minuscule representation of minorities in certain kinds of spaces. So it needs to be questioned why that happens in general. But it's also true, as she says, that why is it going to, are we going to come to a point where only Muslims will defend Muslims and Hindus will defend Hindus? I mean, exactly the kind of question that bothers one when you're thinking of this Muzaffarnagar violence, where people are not willing to return. It's very difficult to say, you know, you must go back because, you know, if nobody is going to be punished. But also then, do you start promoting the fact that, okay, you can only be safe if you live in a Muslim village with Muslims, and then only safe in a Hindu village with Hindus? I mean, is that the kind of country we're looking for, and that's the kind of spaces we live in? I think we all need to think about these issues and then think along these broader lines that how does one intervene in issues of, you know, whether it's the communal violence bill, or what can we do as ordinary citizens, as people at universities, in research, etc. I think some of those are things that universities can do, even as, you know, solidarity associations, but also in the course of your work, when you're researching, when we are, I mean, try and bring up some of these larger questions and try and see what are the best ways to address them, and most of all, what is the kind of world we want to live in and see justice being done. Thank you.
Last item is, well, I invite Basharat from Jamia Student Solidarity to come and give his vote of thanks.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the organizers, Jamia Teachers Solidarity Association and Jamia Student Solidarity Forum, I would like to extend a warm thanks and gratitude to Advocate Vrinda Grover for an extensive, elaborate, and rather an anatomical study of the communal violence that's unfolding in the country, India. To be an advocate in the contemporary times in a country like India is the most daunting task, because given the way our judicial system is operating, it has become a sewage system, wherein the corridors have become a sewage system. And you can understand, for someone like me who comes from a place called Kashmir, you can understand where that comes from. I would also like to thank Professor Farida Khan, member of National Commission of Minorities, for chairing this session, and also all of you for coming over here for this lecture. Thank you very much.